Gorgeous George and Ghost, are you ready? Junkie Nation, are you ready? Well, let's get it on!
From the fight capital of the world, Las Vegas, Nevada, this is MMA Junkie Radio.
We rollin'!
What's going on, Junkie Nation? Gorgeous George and Goes reporting for duty on a Wednesday night for your Thursday morning delivery. Excited to talk some more UFC 300 fallout, discuss the latest news. We're going to do a lot of that. And then we got a fun interview for you with Ricardo Lamas, which also kind of actually is in relation to UFC 300. I'm telling you, man, this show was massive. And it's been fun catching up with the latest news and the stuff, the content that's being put out. Everyone's still talking about it. That makes me happy. That means the buzz is still out there. So this is going to be a fun show. Buckle up. We're going to have a good time. Goes, listen to this tweet from John McCarthy. He says, it is inherently bad for the sport and unbelievably embarrassing to hear people who supposedly know the sport of MMA smear the actions of Herb Dean. He's tagged, by the way. John sending a message here. By the actions of at Herb Dean MMA, as if he was responsible for the knockout of at Jamal H. And then he tags UFC at UFC 300. Let's make this as clear as possible for everyone. Herb was perfect in the actions he took in allowing at Alex Pereira UFC to call off the timeout for the kick to the groin he took and then keep the action of the fight in motion. The fighter who was fouled by the strike to the groin is in control of how much time they need to sufficiently recover from the foul. They have up to 5 minutes of time if they need it. Many times fighters do not want to stop in the action because they feel they have gained momentum in the fight and do not want to give any time to their opponent. Everything Herb Dean did was exactly what we would train any official to do under the circumstances. Luckily, we had an official in the cage who understands the rules and the mechanics needed to successfully manage a world title fight instead of the talking heads that guess at what is right or wrong. Dude, Big John, that's a sledgehammer, no?
Big time. You know what, though? I will disagree on one thing. I don't think it's the end of the world. I think if Alex looks over and says, I'm okay, you know? I think that's good, but I would probably steer away from fighters putting their hands on refs, you know, whether it's friendly or not, like you're just not there for that, you know?
Though in a sense of like assaulting the ref or nah, what?
Just anything, you know, like in that case, I think he kind of put his hand on his like forearm, right? Like, cause at the end of the day, you're not running the show. He is, right? The referee. Mm-hmm. And so I wouldn't want other people to kind of follow suit with that. Okay. But yeah, what happened, you know, the way it went down doesn't happen too often, but I think it was very clear for everyone. He thought there was a foul. There was a foul, but Alex pretty much told him, I'm good to go. There's no need for any of this. And the fight continued. I don't see anything wrong with that.
I didn't see it either. And what they're saying, so apparently DC's had an opinion on this. Chael Sonnen's had an opinion on this. Frankly, I don't catch every minute of every show, so I might be missing a few. But it sounds like maybe that interruption might have thrown Jamal Hill off. Now, DC, to be fair, said Jamal's yet to make an excuse. And that's true. He took it on the chin. Once he saw what happened in the octagon, he congratulated Alex Pereira. I read his lips and said, I respect you. And then Alex said, hey, listen, this guy was really respectful coming up to me and asking for the signature. Because remember, Jamal Hill was getting either a sweatshirt or a t-shirt signed or something like that by everyone. Mm-hmm. He goes, but yeah. Then all of a sudden he starts breaking out that Easter Island, you know, what would you call that? I guess a sculpture of one of the heads from Easter Island, you know, that Alex Fajeda looks like it. And to be fair, it's not a bad joke, right? So from Fajeda's point of view, I mean, he might be like, bitch, why are you being friendly and then bagging? But I don't think, at the same time, I'd probably go, hey, that kind of was funny, and he's probably trying to sell the fight, maybe. So I think Fajeda might also be maybe a slad touchy. Who knows? I appreciated Hill's last minute efforts to kind of get things going a little bit.
Yeah.
So, you know, I see both sides, but again, I'm not upset at anyone.
Well, a couple things, George.
Hill's giving him his flowers, is all I'm saying. Go ahead.
Well, a couple things here. One, the joke isn't the Easter Island, because he cracks that joke on himself. He always does that. It's the blood that was coming out of its nose, and I think its eye was kind of jacked up, right? So he's basically saying, I'm going to jack you up. But then at the same time, what do you expect, right? You guys aren't going to give each other hugs and kisses. You're out there to fight. Like you said, the one thing that was kind of missing on this card was heat. Mm-hmm. Nobody really had it. Everybody was really respectful of one another. So I think that move was important, and it played a big role. And I think Alex, the translator, said that he said, I'm going to make him remember this moment, you know, what he just did and what he just said.
Right.
Well, it built something. It was worth it. It probably maybe sold a couple more pay-per-views, right? You never know. That's one thing. The second thing, I understand where Daniel Cormier is coming from with this. And who was the other one that said it?
Sonnen, I guess.
Sonnen. Here's something that kind of happens to us all. It's happened to me. When you do a show, and when you do it as regular as George and I have done it throughout the years, it's just not interesting to show up and kind of talk about things that everybody already knows. So you look at different angles and different ways to break things down and to kind of stand out, right? Because everybody and their mother's doing the same thing. They're all talking about the same shit. So sometimes you do kind of find different avenues to talk about. And sometimes there's just nothing there. And maybe we just overreach a little bit. This one might be a little bit of an overreach. I do get what they mean. You know, I could see that throwing somebody off their game a little bit. But he didn't complain. No, his corner didn't complain. So it's a kind of a mute point at this point.
Yeah. It is interesting when people can show up with different takes and points of view, but I just don't like it when it's a stretch. And I would agree with John. That's a little bit of a stretch. I've watched that video a few times now, and it doesn't look like to me that Jamal's thrown off. Plus, no rule was broken. And, you know, it would be like maybe a pitcher when he's going to wind up, and then all of a sudden the guy steps out of the batter's box and that I can see a pitcher maybe finishing his throw or whatever. That whole little sequence could possibly throw him off. But this one was one where Jamal kicked him, and then Herb saw what happened, but then Alex told him no. And then there's still like a few seconds in between of them still going back to where they were at. And so I think that's a stretch to say that caused the possible knockdown followed by the knockout. I would just disagree with DC and with Sonnen. And if it does throw fighters off, well, guess what, man? A lot of things kind of throw fighters off. You know, there's a lot of things that happen in a fight that throw fighters off. So that's just, I mean, athletes get thrown off by a lot of things that occur in games, and that's just part of the game. I mean, sometimes, have you ever seen when a defensive back is trying to guard a receiver, but sometimes the route goes right by the umpire? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? That he might not be expecting is there, which is really hard to say because now that's so common that, you know, but there's just things that happen throughout play, you know, and you have to get around it. So hell, sometimes I see referees barely getting out of the way or whatever, but that's the fight game isn't perfect. You're not 100% always in focus about and in control over what's happening. It's chaos in there, you know, and sometimes it could be costly, I suppose, but I don't think this was one of them.
I would be very careful and cautious a little bit to some of the former fighters and current fighters. I like to really, really look at a situation before I come down on a judge or a referee, an official, because this is not the NBA. This is not the NFL. Those guys get paid a lot of money. And if one of them doesn't show up to work, there's another guy just as qualified, ready to take his spot. And at the end of the day, this is life. You know, when you do something and you're embarrassed or people are criticizing you, sometimes it'll weigh on you a little bit. Saw Kerry Hatley, right, in his incident, and he kind of stepped away for about a month before he came back. I would caution people to be careful when you're, if you're going to criticize a ref, I'm not saying you can't do it. I'm just saying, don't just start making shit up. The last thing you want are these guys to be on edge and to be reacting to shit that people are putting on social media and all that. Because guess what? If Herb Dean says, my nerves are shot, I'm walking away from this one, or I got to take a step back, I don't know that there's very many people that are as qualified as him to just take his shoes and roll with the punches. So really, when it comes down to criticism of these guys, you have to really make sure you know what you're saying. And what I get it. Like, I don't think what they're saying is outrageously crazy or anything like that. I understand that, you know, sometimes a little bit of a restart or reset that can throw off your rhythm. But at the end of the day, if the guy didn't complain about it, what are we doing complaining about it?
Mm. Yeah. And that's exactly what Hill did. He's really taken this L pretty good. He, you know, he posted on social media, kind of like life goes on. He still went through with his post-fight party at Hakkasan, I think it was. And then I see him the next day, I think at a pool party or whatever, enjoying life. Kind of, and that's what you got to do, you know. Today goes, I swear to God, I felt like I'm like a philosopher. My three nieces, who I took to Fridays to lunch about 3 months ago, we had a good time, and one of them thought the bartender was cute, and the other two coaxed the bartender into taking a picture with her, and then they were kind of cracking up because they put her in an embarrassing spot. And so I was back at Fridays and I was laughing, and I sent them a message saying, I remember the last time we were here, and I still got the picture of the guy, because the bartender kind of looks like that Bad Bunny dude that all the all the girls are into or whatever. And one of them, the one that got embarrassed, says, oh, how embarrassing. I haven't been to Fridays since that day. Ha, ha, ha. And I told her, I swear, goes, I either just made this up or someone else really has thought of this. And my words came out identical, but I was actually pretty proud of this. I'm going to read this to you. I told her, life doesn't begin until when one can laugh at themselves. Mm-hmm. It seems like once you can get past that, like failing or laughing, you know, being the butt of a joke, but laughing along and all that, it's like all of a sudden you mature, you let stuff roll off your back, like water off a duck. You just kind of start to move on because you're not afraid to fall, they say, you know, like when you're on the road to success or whatever, if you're not failing, you know, things aren't going right. You have to fail a little bit, you know? So
yeah.
Jamal's dealing with this pretty good so far. And he went all in on it, you know? And so trust me, it has to be eating at him. But if he had knocked out Fajita, dude, he would have been massive. Come Monday, because again, he talked the shit and then he backed it up, but it didn't work out. But I still tip my hat for him taking that route.
Well, look, Jamal Hill, one of the things that I've always liked about him is he can kind of bring things into perspective and keep it real. I thought he was getting away from that a little bit, but do you remember when he lost to the dude from Scotland? What's his name?
Paul Craig, who, Paul by Craig. The way, owns wins against Ankalaev. think Rakic and Jamal Hill, like, he's got three top seven or eight wins at light heavyweight. Now he's competing as a middleweight, but I've always respected that guy for that.
Well, he took that one on the chin and he said all the right things, but he didn't just say it. He did them and he turned things around. And next thing you know, he's got gold around his waist, right? So I wouldn't be shocked if this is just another lesson along the way. And he turns things around and can possibly recapture his title. I mean, this isn't, it's weird because in a way it can be a deep division, but in another way it's not, because so many of them have faced each other already. So I could see him rebuilding things, but.
Me too. But it's almost like the opposite of what we were saying about Ronda Rousey a few weeks ago, either on Spinning Back Click or here on Junkie Radio. I can't remember, maybe even both. Where she was so caught up in the demise that she had for that moment, right? And then she was unrealistic about her approach to what had happened, still calling it a win and all some other bullshit. And now it's complicated her personal life, you know? And now someone who was beloved by the fans, well, I'm sure she still has some, but a lot of them are like, bro, you're not really on the same planet as I am, you know? Because we all get up and fail kind of every day. It's just... theirs are obviously super highs and super lows, but it doesn't mean just because you lost a fight that all of a sudden you're some loser or anything like that. You know, on the contrary, I mean, Ronda was pretty much a legend in the making at the time when she lost to Ronda Holly Holm. But yeah, I don't agree with everything that Jamal Hill does, but honestly, I don't agree with everything most people say. Anyway, we're not supposed to. That would be kind of boring. So... if for the most part is once you dress all that down, is it a good person? So far, Jamal strikes me as a good person.
Well, okay. So earlier in our conversation, I kind of mentioned that like our job isn't just to have a take, because everyone can do that. Sometimes you have to look a little deeper into things. And so one thing that I can tell you guys that maybe not everybody thinks of or whatever, Brian Butler is in Jamal Hill's corner. Okay. Brian Butler is a guy who's had many champions who have at times lost their belts and built their way back. Carla Esparza's one. Rose Namajunas is another person that has taken some L's here and been able to turn things around. Max Holloway, he was a part of for a while, right? Like, he's had fighters that have kind of dipped down and been able to come back. And I think he has just a good perspective on the sport, a good way of taking care of his fighters and directing them in the right direction. And his stable, you know, this isn't a shot at him. It's a decent stable. It's large, but it's not as large as some of the other ones. And I do think that's for a reason. I think it's because he likes to be a little hands-on. Mm-hmm. And so right off the bat, I think you got a good mind that's kind of guiding you in a good direction. That'll give you good advice. So if I'm Jamal Hill, I really listen to him. I listen to some of the former guys, like Sucker Punch guys. Jens Pulver is a good person to pick up the phone and talk to. You know, he's been there. But I think that's the start, man, is, you know, take in as much as you can from your peers, people who have been there. And like George said, like, you can almost apply what you're saying about our cousin to Jamal Hill, in the sense that that's about as bad as it's going to get, right? And you survived. And now it's just time to rebuild.
I would honestly just retweet the memes, laugh along, you know, because you're not going to fight with everyone on the internet. It's just going to get worse. It's going to become an avalanche. So you might as well just step back and go, well, what would I do? And more than likely, I would tell each fighter, bitch, what do most of you do anyway? We all sit around at fight parties when we're not at the event, and we kind of clown like, oh, someone's going to have a headache or, you know, or whatever, depending on how much of a jerk they are, then we give it back to them. Or if they're pretty cool, you just go, I hope he does. I hope he's all right tomorrow, whatever. But we're all doing that. I've been with fighters at a certain spot, and the ones that lose that are kind of assholes or whatever, you know, they're getting it. They're getting it from people or whatever. So that's just kind of the way it is all I can say, is accept it, move on, you know, and that's that, really. What do you think of my proverb or whatever that is saying?
What was the quote again?
It was, life doesn't begin until when one can laugh at themselves.
Yeah. I like it.
Yeah, I was kind of happy with that. Once I wrote it, I was like, hey, that almost sounds like something a philosopher once said. And like I say, I just really just made it up at that moment. But I've always felt pretty strong about that.
Mm-hmm.
You got me, you know. You know when people say touche, when you clown them and you're expecting them to fire back and you're ready to fire back again, but sometimes someone just looks at you and goes touche, almost like I got nothing, you know, you got me, that's just it, and then you laugh it off.
I think Danny said that on the last spinning back click. Yeah. Sometimes you just take your L, man, and come back another day.
Mm-hmm. You know, I gotta give props to Michael Chandler. He's been getting shit on, and maybe even rightfully so. I think he was a little bit too long of a bridesmaid, right? He's going to be a bride soon, or as terrible as that might sound, I suppose, whatever other thing you want to come up with. But he's been basically kind of on hold, waiting for the date. He realizes this is a big fight. But man, in one comment, I felt like he's really, really almost gained a little bit of, he'll gain a little bit of respect. I respect all this guy, so it's not really coming from me. But he's saying that, yeah, this, you know, McGregor saying this is the biggest comeback, or this is going to be, you know, quite a big fight, and this comeback's going to be as big as it gets. But Chandler's now saying, by the way, this, I'm retiring you. So that story's going to have, you know, a little side plot to it all. Mm-hmm. I kind of like that, this whole greatest combat thing that you have going on. I have other plans and I'm retiring you. Cause not only is he saying I'm beating you, I'm going to beat you so bad, I'm retiring you. And I'm thinking, what if Conor comes back and only he'll know, right? But what if his leg just isn't what it is, and he takes a vicious KO? As rich as he is, could you see Conor, honestly, after the Khabib thing, the Poirier losses, even the Nate Diaz loss? Maybe he comes back for a trilogy with Nate because they're 1-1. But isn't there honestly a chance where you're just going to go, man, fuck all this, I'm out?
Yes. Because even Conor McGregor only has so many lives. He has way more than everyone else. But the Nate thing, I mean, look, at this point, it all comes down to his contract, because yes, there is a trilogy to play out, but it's been so fucking long. Who cares at this point? But here's the thing. If he doesn't sign a new contract, then why not do that somewhere else and collect most of that money, right? If I'm Conor McGregor, you could retire from MMA and go box someone and make more money doing other things. Jorge Masvidal, it's probably still around. Nate Diaz, you could fight him. You could fight old Jake Paul, I'm sure would be itching at something like that. But you could collect most of that money if you're your own promoter, right? Now, the UFC would make it very difficult for you to get away, but I wouldn't be shocked at something like that. What I liked about Michael Chandler's comments that cracked me up was he called himself Mystic Mike, and he called for a round 2 finish. I thought that was great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I like that he's all in. Let's face it, even Chandler said it, I don't think he's going to be around the sport for that much longer. I could see anywhere between 3 to 5 fights, depending on, obviously, if it's 3 straight fucking knockouts, you know, he'd probably be done. But if he were to win this one, lose the next one, then I could see him probably doing another one. You know, I just think this guy's a star. He's fun to watch, and he loves competing. But at the same time, he's realizing, man, I just lost a year and a half waiting for McGregor. I got to make this one count. So I kind of like that he's kind of flipping the script, putting a little bit of pressure on McGregor. If it comes through, he gets all of McGregor, you know, a lot of the McGregor hype, and now becomes Chandler hype. So that could be a huge, huge night for him. This is one way to make up for the lost time.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, so good on Michael Chandler for going that route. I'm sure McGregor will have something to say about it. I'm sure he'll fire back and say, well, that's funny, those are the same plans I had for you and whatever. How about Topuria saying, hey, Holloway, all right, we're gonna fight, but you're putting up that BMF title while I put up the undisputed title. A, do you like that strategy? B, do you think the UFC should allow it?
I agree with half of what he said. I do think that that belt kind of has to be on the line, but I don't think that belt should be transferable to champions. So my reasoning behind that is this. This particular belt didn't really stand for like who the baddest man in combat sports is. It's more just who's a real tough cat that would anytime, any place fight, right? Mm-hmm. Your champion of whatever your division, he should be really realistically the BMF, right, of that division. He is the top dog. If they asked you which belt would you rather have, you'd want that belt. So what I think should happen, should this ever come to that, where a BMF has to face a champion, if he loses the BMF, but the BMF goes back into circulation, into somebody else's hands, right? Like you just come up with another fight. But I don't think you should have a champion and a BMF. I mean, to me, that's a little silly. Which belt's on the line? You know, what does it mean when somebody loses their belt? Are they still a champion, you know, because they're the BMF? Do they put the BMF on? Like, to me, all that is a little silly. So realistically, what I think should happen is I think that belt should just go back into circulation.
Well, I like that Topuria rolled the dice and put it out there, because two birds with one stone, you know, if they bite, if DOC bites and says, all right, fuck it, you know, let's do it, then cool. I understand what Danny Segura has been saying on SBC, that to be involved in the BMF, we're not looking for choir boys. We're not looking for team captains. We're looking for bad hombres, you know, that have maybe broken the law or gotten into fisticuffs on the street or whatever. It kind of embodies more those three letters. But I don't know Topuria's past. Maybe he is this badass. But man, when you're undefeated and you take out Alex Volkanovski right away, I don't care if you have a clean record or not, you're kind of a BMF there, right? And if you can take off Volkanovski and take out Holloway, like, this might qualify. But the beauty of BMF, it's almost undefined. It can have 17 different definitions. You know, you ask fans, media, other fighters, what is a BMF? I think they'll all give you different versions of what the BMF is. So that's nice. I actually appreciate him kind of trying to kill two birds with one stone.
It's like, I'll give you an analogy in basketball. To me, LeBron James he's kind of got it all, right? He's a great defensive player. He's obviously fantastic offensive. But when you compare him to Kobe Bryant, Kobe Bryant was a bad motherfucker. I think there's a difference. He was like ice cold. He would get in your face. He would talk shit. He would just pull this different level out of himself, where LeBron is just more X's and O's type of guy. That's what I think is the difference between what you would see a BMF in the UFC versus just a champion.
Yeah. Well, if Holloway's smart, he might go for it, because if he can categorize this as champion versus champion, then maybe he can coax the UFC into giving him pay-per-view points, because I know those pay-per-view points have been a part of some of the BMF history. So never dismiss it. That's why I always say never dismiss the interim belt and never dismiss this possible BMF belt, because if they're advertising it and making it look like something and making you go five rounds, then you should reap the benefits too of the other side. Maybe you don't get $2 a pay-per-view or a dollar. Maybe you only get a quarter per pay-per-view or 50 cents. It's something though, and it will add up. It's going to definitely probably be more than one of those $50,000 bonuses. So I would definitely get behind it. I think Aspinall should rock that belt. And if Aspinall doesn't want to wait for John Jones, he should defend the belt, the interim belt, and make that money too.
Yeah.
All right. Now's a good time to break away and talk to Ricardo Lamas. He's got a lot to say. Like I say, in a way, he has something to do with those final 10 seconds of Holloway and Gaethje. And he's a good friend of the show, honestly. And I've also seen him active as of late on social media. His dad has a great story that he wants to share, so he really wants to get on Joe Rogan. So let's talk about all this with the bully, Ricardo Lamas. What's going on, Junkie Nation? Gorgeous George and Goes checking in. We always deliver the big names. Ricardo Lamas is a good friend of the show. We've covered him since the days of the WEC, then the UFC, and then even that, after that, he joined us for a military morale visit. So it's always great to see you, Rick. How you doing, man?
I'm doing good. How are you guys doing?
Good. Good, good. And, you know, we follow each other on social media, and you've been popping up a lot on my timeline, so I thought it would be a great time to catch up. First of all, I got to get your thoughts on UFC 300. First that, the event, you know, the magnitude of it and all that. And then, you know what I'm probably going to ask about next, and that's that Holloway Gaethje last 10-second ending. You've been in one of those types of battles, right? Two bulls locking up at the very end. So maybe you can tell us what you thought as you watched that, being that you've experienced it, you know, as a fighter, and then obviously now as a fan. So 300, start off with that. What'd you think of that first?
300, you know, we were talking about this a little before we hopped on and started recording. It's not like it was an event that the main event and co-main event had everybody like jaw dropped or anything like that. Great fights in the main event and co-main event. But just the whole card from top to bottom was just ridiculous. I mean, you're opening up the early prelims with two former champs in Cody Garbrandt and Davison Figueiredo. Like, how could you go wrong from there, right? Two former champs battling it out. And it was just, you know, finish after finish. And, of course, when you raise the prize, the bonuses, the $300,000, you're going to have guys gunning for those bonuses. So it made for a very exciting night. I thought all the fights were awesome. Obviously, I think my favorite fight of the night, like everybody else's, was the BMF fight. And I just want to say you're welcome to everyone, because I was the one that coaxed that moment out of Max Holloway. You know, you can listen to Max talk about it. He actually did a interview with Demetrius Johnson. And even though he threw a little shade at me, but he said he loved me. So it's okay. I love you too, Max. You know, he was saying that in the third round of our fight, I kept waving him in and waving him in. And then finally, in the last 10 seconds, that's why he decided to point to the ground and give me that chance to duke it out. But he made it seem like I did that because I didn't think we were, like, really fighting. He's like, listen, Max, I knew I was down on the scorecards. I knew I was losing that fight. And in my head, in the last half of that third round, I'm like, listen, only chance I got right now is to kind of coax him into a brawl, and hopefully I catch him with something, which is what he did to Gaethje. That's what I was hoping for, but it didn't work out. But we created that epic moment, and it took, let's see, that was 199. So it took 101 UFC pay-per-views to recreate it, but they finally did it, and he did the perfect ending to it, man. I couldn't think of any better ending to a fight for the BMF title than what happened on Saturday night.
Yeah, no doubt. It was very similar to yours, and he actually referenced the fact that he knew, you know, like you said, in your fight, you're down. And so you're kind of throwing a last minute strategy to bring him in to see if you can clip him. And then from his end, he's actually up, you know, but still was willing to take that risk. But the thought was in the head because of a seed you planted. Those last 10 seconds, can you even hear the fans as you guys are just wailing, you know, and you're ducking, I'm sure. And what are those 10 seconds like? How long does it feel like? Does it feel like 10 seconds? Does it feel like 10 minutes? Can you hear the crowd, or is it just like, you know, like just silence?
It's definite tunnel vision. I didn't hear the crowd till after, like when we're done and the bell rang, you know, the crowd kind of erupted. But it's definitely tunnel vision, and there's not much going through my head except for like, I hope I don't fall down and I hope my punch lands. But it was just like, it was an instinctive moment, kind of like a survival thing, right? Where you're just throwing with everything you got and you're hoping that the guy in front of you falls and you end up staying up on your feet. So definitely survival mode, you know, that fight mode. And, you know, I'll be waiting patiently for my 10% finder's fee for creating that moment with Max. So Max, if you need my address, just hit me up in the DMs and I'll send it to you.
To be fair, let's just say he did. And then Gilbert Melendez and Diego Sanchez said, well, that was nice of Max to do that. Now we're waiting for Rick's 10% of that.
But 10%. there was no point down to the ground, though. It's different. They brawled it out a little bit, but he pointed. I said, yes, thank you. That's what I was waiting for. And then we started slugging out. So
I am curious, but, though, did Gil and Diego kind of, are they on the same page as what you guys did? Remember that one? And
Yes, course I remember it. That was an awesome fight. I remember watching it, jumping out of my seat for that, you know, for their brawl. And then Diego dropping him, like, in the closing seconds of the last round. Those two guys, like, I've rarely ever seen either one of them in a boring fight. So those guys were fan pleasers, both of them. And when you put two fan pleasers against each other, that's the type of fight that you get.
Yeah. Well, it was BMF. You're all BMFs, man. One way or another, some of you are just a little bit more extreme than the rest. But yeah, it was a classic moment. I definitely was thinking about you. And you know what? 199. You know, everybody talks about 300 was the best fight card ever. And probably on paper from top to bottom it was, but 199 was pretty damn good too, man. There was some great fights on that fight card. Goes was there in person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What do you think? Is that a 1 and 2? Because to me, that was in the UFC. That was my favorite card going into this weekend. My favorite of all time is Pride 33. But 199 was absolutely amazing from the first fight on. Where do you think you were on 199? Where do you think it lies compares to 300?
You know, I don't think I ever really sat back and watched the whole card from beginning to end. You know, when I'm there, I'm really focused on my fight. I don't really like watching the fights that are going on when I'm backstage. So I didn't really know like how great the fights were. Obviously afterwards I could sit back a little bit and watch. And I know the last, you know, the main event with Jones and Cormier was an awesome, was it Jones Cormier? Was that the right word?
Hendo and Bisping.
Hendo Bisping.
No. Wait, 199 or 100?
199.
No, 199 was when Bisping knocked out Rockhold. Yeah. Hendo knocked out.
It was Bisping Rockhold.
Hector Lombard and Dominic Cruz and Uriah Faber went at it.
Yeah. Dustin Poirier was on that. Bobby Green. I think Tony Ferguson was on that card. It was let me pull this card. Man.
Rockhold wins the title.
It's hard to when you're fighting on the card, it's hard to realize how good the card is because you're so focused on your fight and you don't really see everything else that's going on. You don't experience it like a spectator that's out in the stands.
Mm-hmm. Hey, let me ask you something about that moment since George brought it up. Look, this is not a barroom brawler sport. There's a lot of strategy. You guys work on a lot of things. But going forward, when Max does that, can you say no as a fighter? I mean, there's as much strategy as there is, there's also a lot of bravado in our sport. Can somebody just say, nah, I'm not playing that game? Or do you think everybody just gets lured into that?
Well, what's special about Max doing it is, you know, the two main times that he's known for doing it, the first time with me and now at the BMF title, was he was up on the scorecards. So he was going to win the fight. And then he still, like, as a showman, right, steps in the middle of the octagon, points to the ground, and gives his opponent a chance to swing with all they have at him in the final seconds of a fight that he is about to win. So he takes a huge risk, but you know, they say with big risk brings big reward also. So he gambled and he won both times. You know, he's a great fighter and a great person too. You know, I've known Max since when he first got in the UFC. We hung out at, you know, like a fighter summit. We went bowling together and, you know, got to know him a little bit, and not only is he a great fighter, but he's a great guy too.
You know, I want to ask you a little bit about Big Reward. I was at the press conference for this one, and I told the guy sitting next to me, when they announced $300,000 bonuses, to me, that changed everything. How I looked at some of these fights, how some of these fighters could potentially fight, depending on where you're at, how close you are to a title. Some of these guys were a little bit closer to maybe being on their way out, so maybe all that didn't matter as much. If you were still going today, what would a $300,000 bonus do to your game plan?
It's like, you know, it's like buying a lottery ticket for a much smaller pool of people that are out there, you know, competing for that prize. And I don't know how these bonuses got shrunken down to $50,000. I remember back in the day, they were usually always $100,000. The first bonus I won, it was UFC on Fox One. It was, you know, I think it was like $65,000 that I won for submission of the night against Cub Swanson. But then somewhere along the way, Dana just kind of set them all at 50, which is great. You know, $50,000 extra, $50,000 in your pocket is great. But when you're talking about the highest, you know, the pinnacle of this sport, I think the bonuses should be more. And I think you'll get guys risking more to win those bonuses. And with that, you'll get more exciting fights.
You watch a card like that, Ricardo, what's that like? I'm sure you get a little bit of the itch. Could we ever see you come back and do this just one more time?
Yeah, it definitely brings up, you know, a lot of nostalgia and gives me that itch for sure. For me to come back, I'd have to dedicate all my time to training and doing that. So I would, you know, I'm retired, but never say never. And everybody, for the right price, you know, I'd be willing to come back for sure.
Who would you want to fight?
Who would I want to fight? If I'm going to come back, it's got to be for a big fight. Any huge name, you know, Conor McGregor, maybe anybody that I even lost to, you know, to come back and get a second crack at avenging those losses. So I think with the name that I've built, if I come back, it'd have to be with somebody in the top 10.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's funny. I did write down McGregor's name because you kind of were one of the first to poke at him on social media. And you actually got under his nerves because you kind of did skits and things like that.
Yeah.
Since then, did you guys ever cross paths? And did he ever at least say, yeah, that was a good one? Or did you ever cross paths? Let's start with that.
We crossed paths the weekend that I went live with that video. When I put it on YouTube, we crossed paths in an elevator in Boston.
Okay, now take your time. I want to hear the details. How did this go? Who's in the elevator? For how many floors? How did this one go? Don't skim on the details.
No, I won't skimp on the details. So I was in the elevator with my wife, and Baboon was with me on that fight. They had brought me out to McGregor's fight to announce my main event fight with Chad Mendes. We get on the elevator. So it's us three, and then there's at least four other people on there. And I'm buried in my phone because from there I'm supposed to go somewhere else and do some more promotions with Chad Mendes. So they're trying to get me to approve flights and stuff, and I'm, like, buried in my emails just on the phone, I'm totally oblivious to what's going on around me. Elevator stops, door opens, some more people get on, and I'm just on my phone, right? And then I start feeling like somebody tapping my foot, right? And I think it's my wife next to me. And then elevator comes to a stop at, like, the next floor. The door opens up. I look up, and I see that it was McGregor that got on with, like, his entourage into the elevator. And I look up, and he's just looking at me, but he's not saying anything. And they start walking off, and, like, right as he's about to exit, then he decides to say something. And he goes, "That was a pussy video, yeah." And then I just busted out laughing as loud as I could. And Baboon helped me out. He came back. He's like, "That's because we made it about a pussy." And like, then he got off with his entourage, and that was it. Like, the door is closed. But like, he obviously saw me when he got on the elevator, but didn't say anything until he was walking off. So, I mean, he was right in the middle of his weight cut too. So he was pretty sucked down. I'm sure he probably wasn't in the mood to get into a fight, especially since he had a fight like 2 days later. But yeah,
do you remember who he was fighting?
The whole story.
Do you remember who he was fighting? That weekend?
He was fighting the German dude, the old guy.
Dennis Seaver,
yeah.
Okay.
He was fighting Dennis Seaver. That was in Boston.
Who was his entourage? I want to picture what the numbers.
His girlfriend, and just some other people from his camp. I can't remember if John Kavanaugh was on there or not, but I think he was going to do open workouts.
So there was four of them. One was a female and three guys, including McGregor.
I know it was his girlfriend or wife. Right. I don't know if they're married or not, but it was her and then a couple other people from his camp, probably some of his other coaches. Like I said, I was like oblivious, and then I saw him, and then he walked off and said that, and I was just laughing. So that's how
I know Frank Trigg and Bruce Buffer once got in a fight in an elevator with Dana White at the sandbag.
I've heard Frank Trigg tell the story, and it's hilarious.
Yeah.
I have a question, Rick. So as the doors are closing, if Baboon makes that comment, he probably gets a fist bump from me, a good one, you know? But you know, sometimes the doors just reopen for some
reason.
He might get an elbow. Like, what are you doing?
Stop it.
What would have happened if the doors reopened? Like, were they trying to say something back as the doors were closing, or was that?
No, I think they were, I think they were trying to get him out of there. And, you know, luckily there was no altercation. My wife, my wife at the time was pregnant. Like, we're on an elevator. So if something were going to go down, one of us was not going to leave that elevator alive. So, it's good that nothing did go down.
My next question was going to be, well, what if the guys fell out of the elevator? You know how in a hockey fight,
what if we got stuck? No, what if the elevator stopped and we got stuck in the elevator, right? And then we had to come up with a bunch of games to entertain ourselves while they got it fixed and stuff. And then me and McGregor end up becoming best friends after that. You never know, right?
Tag team partners, you go to WWE, you know. But what I was going to say was, you know, in the hockey fight, they'll fight and the goalies are just kind of hanging back watching the goal. I was going to ask you, how would you size up how your wife would have done against D? I think that's his girlfriend's name. Like, is your wife a fighter or is she more like?
Yeah, she was. She did. My wife has had a couple amateur kickboxing fights.
Oh.
She was a black belt in Taekwondo in her younger days. So.
Okay, so she wasn't scared then, other than the fact that she was pregnant.
No, and she grew up in the hood, man. You know how these Mexican hood girls are. So D better watch out.
That's the Chicago way, like the Untouchables. That's right. Wow, that's hilarious, man. Listen, I saw your name pop up for other reasons as well. Rogan, tell me about this. You were scheduled to go on, or
I wasn't scheduled. I wasn't scheduled.
And this regards your dad, right, in his story?
Yeah, so this is how the whole thing started. I'm a huge Joe Rogan fan. I listen to his podcast all the time. I was actually listening to it on the way home right now. But I was listening to one episode when he had Yoel Romero on. And then he had Joey Diaz, like, kind of translating. I don't know if you guys remember that episode. And he had good, you know, I loved the podcast and all the stories he was telling. But Joe was kind of like, he'd ask him these questions that Yoel would kind of avoid. And one of the questions was, how did you see Fidel Castro? You know, how did you see him? Who was he to you? And all Yoel said was, I just saw him as the president. And that's it. And he didn't go into anything else. He just kind of left that question as it was. So after I got done watching that, I hopped on Twitter, and this is back when Joe would actually read tweets and respond and stuff. So I said, "Hey Joe, I just saw your show with Yoel, and I think the reason why he wasn't really talking about Fidel is because he still has family in Cuba, and I think he's got a son in Cuba still. So you don't want to talk bad about the regime when you have family there, because they could make it very hard on your family who's still living there." And I said, "My father was born in Cuba. He was born in a free democratic Cuba. He was actually born in the year that the Cuban constitution was made after they won their independence from Spain. He saw the takeover of the first dictator, Fulgencio Batista, who was an elected president, but decided to remain in power because he claimed that the upcoming elections were going to be fraudulent. So he threw a coup d'etat and remained in power, which gave Castro the excuse to throw his revolution. So my dad saw all of that. Like many Cubans, he didn't know how to feel about Fidel in the beginning because Fidel ignored a lot of his communist ties. And he actually applied to be a volunteer to go up and teach farmers who joined the revolution how to read and write. So he got elected for that. He went up into the Sierra Maestra Mountains where the army was in 1960. This was the year after Fidel came into power. And what he saw up there, he got kicked out of there, actually. So they told him he had to leave. And what he saw up there made him change his mind about the revolution. And when he came back down, that's when he decided to fight against the revolution. And he was the president of a national student sector of this movement called the 30th of November movement, the Frank Pais 30th of November movement. He was in charge of propaganda. And I just remember hearing stories upon stories of all these missions that they would do. You know, the police coming to his house, him having to run out the back door, and then his police holding his parents under house arrest for 2 weeks, hoping that he would come back. He spent the next 2 years of his life living where he could, sleeping where he could, and fighting the revolution that way. You know, other stories of almost being apprehended, jumping out of a car, being shot at by the Cuban police.
Wow.
All until this big incident happened where he decided to leave the country after this incident. And this is an incident that I would let him tell because this is more his story, and it's actually very sad what happened. But after he decided to leave, he met with his friend who was like his second in command in his group, gave him all the folders and everything that they'd accrued from all the missions that they'd done. And he said, you know, I'm going to the Brazilian embassy. I'm going to go to the United States. So he took over. Shortly after that, his group was infiltrated by the regime, and his friend that he gave everything to was arrested, tried, charged, and executed within 21 days, sent to the firing squads. So that would have been my dad's fate if he had not escaped at the time that he did. And then, you know, after that, he came to the U.S. But that's the condensed version. Obviously, mm-hmm. there's a lot more. And my dad is just a wealth of knowledge when it comes to the history of Cuba and what happens to a country when you implement socialism and communism into government. So I think it's important, especially for my family, to kind of, I've never really sat with my dad and heard the whole story from beginning to end in full detail. So I think like a podcast would be the best way to do it. And I think it would be a great educational tool for people here in the United States, especially the younger generation who seem to be infatuated with the idea of socialism and communism. And I think that everybody should hear it. I think it'd be a great story, and hopefully we can make it happen. But Joe, to get back to my point, I sent him that message and he responded back right away. He was like, oh my God, that's awesome. When can you come to LA? And I was like, well, fuck, if you're serious, we'll come to LA tomorrow. So he was, at the time he was like, I'm doing a show in Miami. I'll contact you tomorrow. I gave him my cell phone number, but nothing ever came of it. I never heard from him after that. But it seemed like he was interested at the time. So I was just, you know, trying to throw my shot out there again with those tweets and the posts, because in June, my dad turns 84 and, you know, he's kind of one of these stories. Like when he talked to World War II vets, firsthand accounts are pretty much all gone. You know, now it's all like secondhand accounts, secondhand stories. So I want to get his firsthand account before it's too late and it's lost in time. So that was my reasoning for sending out the tweets and stuff.
Okay. So can I follow up a couple questions here? You said part of the story you'd like to leave for your dad to tell, but this may be it. I don't know. Is he somebody that came over, like I hear about, either rafts or boats, or was it through Mexico, or is that the part where you'd rather just him tell?
No, so I can tell you how he didn't come over on a raft. I'm glad, because there have been hundreds of thousands of Cubans who tried to make that trip and lost their lives at sea.
Right.
Someone in his group offered him a pass into the Brazilian embassy in Cuba. Mm-hmm. And through there, he stayed there for a few months. And then they gave him, I forgot what he calls it. They gave him some sort of other pass, but basically he went from the Brazilian embassy with some other people who were seeking political asylum there. They loaded them all on a plane after a few months and flew them to Puerto Rico. And he tells me that, like, when they were getting on that plane, he didn't know where they're, like, he wasn't sure they were sending him to Puerto Rico. He wasn't sure if they were going to, like, send him right back to the regime, you know. But he went to Puerto Rico, and then from Puerto Rico, he had a brother here in Chicago, my uncle Octavio, who sent him the money to then get a flight from Puerto Rico to Chicago. And that's how he got to the United States.
Got it. With him telling the story, is it considered a danger to your family, whether it be in the U.S. or Cuba, or do you at least know that that's not the case?
No, that wouldn't be the case.
Okay, that's good.
I think, you know, all of my immediate family on my dad's side is in the United States now. There's really nobody left in Cuba. If there are, it's got to be like super, super distant relatives that I know nothing about. But I don't even know if there would be any. So there would be no dangers in him telling his side of the story.
Ricardo, so I guess one thing that kind of stands out for me, I do hope that you get this opportunity, by the way. That would be excellent. I think it's something that a lot of people need to be educated on. Yeah. And having a firsthand account is so much different, you know, than reading it in a book or whatever. And so I guess what I wanted to ask you was, when your dad was at that embassy, back then, news didn't travel the way it does today, you know, by text, by even social media. It takes time to find things out. Did he already know by the time he was getting on that plane what had happened to his friend?
That I'm not sure of. I would have to ask him to make sure. I think he might have had an idea, or yeah, I don't know. That's a question that he can answer, and that's a good one because I don't even remember. See, that's why I want to get this going to get the timeline right and really hear everything from beginning to end, and then have something that I can go back to and watch to really kind of let the details sink in. You know, because like I said, I've heard stories growing up all my life, but it's always been one story here, one story there. I've never heard the timeline. I've never heard it from beginning to end. And like when people ask me questions like that, I have to be like, I don't really know, because he doesn't really, when he gets together with, you know, his Cuban friends and his Cuban Civic Committee, they'll sit and talk for hours. And like, they talk about all that stuff. I think with some of the stuff that happened, he doesn't necessarily like talking about it all the time, but he's definitely willing to put a story out there if we were to get onto Joe Rogan, because Joe Rogan has such a huge reach. And I think it would help my dad, you know, ever since my dad left Cuba, he never stopped fighting. Like he's ever since he got here, he's been finding ways to raise money to send back to Cuban dissidents, to help groups that are opposing the regime today. I've even gotten involved in, I don't know if you guys remember, I made a bunch of shirts. I raised almost like $10,000 through selling shirts, and we were able to send that money to groups in Cuba that needed it and to people that needed it. So, I think it would help all around with everything.
Ricardo, we probably never shared this with you, but, we had an uncle pass away a couple months ago and, thank you. A few years back, George was in the car with him and they were driving around where we grew up, and he hadn't noticed it, but he had hit record on his phone and he was just asking him all kinds of stories. About halfway through, he realized he had been recording it, so he just kept asking him questions. And that uncle told so many stories, and hopefully my family forgives me for this, because you know, when he passed away, he wasn't all there, he was a lot older, but we played that audio for his daughters. And they had heard stories that they had never heard before. But as he's telling stories, he would remember things, because there's some of them are stories we've heard before. But it would just jolt his memory, and he would remember little things to him that were little, but to us meant the world, right? Hearing like, oh my God, I didn't know this, I didn't know that. So yeah, I think you and your father going on Joe Rogan, telling that story, you know, who knows how much more he's going to remember, how far this is going to go, as far as the people that it'll affect, right? Not just yourself, but you know, in a way, I'm sure you probably need it yourself, your relationship with your father. I'm sure that would be a great moment. But like we said, the education on the subject, and Joe is so good at, he just doesn't have somebody show up, you know, he does his own research and he's good at asking questions. I think it could be really educational and really great. So I 100% hope that this is something that happens, man, because it's a story that needs to be told.
Yeah, I agree, and I appreciate your guys' help, and you know, hopefully it reaches the right ears and you'll see me on there.
That would be outstanding, my friend. Just to clean up a few things here, UFC 199, I looked at it just to jar your guys' memory.
Yeah.
Bisping defeated Rockhold and won the title. Cruz defended against Faber. That was the end of their trilogy. Holloway and Lamas, you guys were the featured bout. Henderson knocked out Lombard via elbow. Poirier knocked out Green via punches. Ortega knocked out Guida via knee. Dariush knocked out James Vick via one punch KO. Jessica Andrade finished Jessica Penne via TKO stoppage. Alex Caceres beat Cole Miller. Sean Strickland was on the prelims, the early prelims. Wow. And he split decisioned Tom Brees. Enrique de Silva beat Jonathan Wilson, TKO punches. Kevin Casey beat Elvis Mutatic. I haven't heard that name in a long time. What is he, the something rock and roller? Or no, I guess I'm thinking of Marwin Hall, the bipolar rock and roller. But,
no, that was Elvis Sinisek, I think. Or
oh, okay.
Right.
And then Polo Reyes and Dong Hyun Ma had the fight of the night. That was the first fight of the night. They got 50K. You asked about 50K. You're right. It used to be 70, 85, right. 100, 129 at UFC 129 when they were in that big stadium with GSP and Jake Shields.
Yeah.
And then what happened was The fight night bonuses, I think, were 25. So, and I'm not defending Dana White. I'm just giving you the history. I think what Dana said was, rather than these are here and these people are complaining that these are low, we're just going to make them all 50. Now, right. What I think should happen is, I think UFC, since UFC 199, has quadrupled and probably even more in value. And so, yeah, not only should your salaries go up, I think these incentives should go up. I think every finisher should get bonused, for starters. You know, I think it makes the fighters go for it a little bit more, right? And I also think that the bonuses should be higher. I think it's time that they get moved up to 100,000. You know, I'm not even going to say 75 because fuck it, it's been so long. Go to 100 because you guys seem to raise them every 10 years. I'd hate for them to get stuck at 75 for the next 10 years. They can do it, but it takes us talking about it, whether it's a fighter, ex-fighter like yourself, media, and you just push it and push it. I left 165 and 175 alone about a year ago, but I was always talking about that. And then I heard it get brought up this weekend again. Like, I think the UFC could flourish with those divisions because there's so many fighters at lightweight, welterweight, and middleweight, and some are really tweeners, we call them, right? Yeah. So it'd be good for them as well. So there's a lot of things that could definitely get better, but we just got to put them out there. So we're going to try and do that with this. One last thing I wanted to follow up on was you said you'd be open to an MMA fight. It'd have to be a big name. One of your homies is probably the best BKFC fighter of all time, and that's Luis Palomino. He just took his first L at BKFC after 9 fights, 2 world titles. In watching him fight, have you ever thought, man, I kind of wouldn't mind doing that with the UFC's permission, I guess, since you seem to be under contract or whatever. Would you ever explore something like that? Because obviously, an MMA training camp seems to be a lot more taxing than either a boxing or a BKFC one.
Listen, man, if the price is right, I'll explore anything. You know, some new organization pops up where they have dudes fighting in banana hammocks and, you know, dildos in their hand. If you give me the right amount of money, we'll see. Yeah. Uh-huh. Maybe not the dildos, but the banana hammocks.
Yeah, I think we'll see if we can edit that part out. But you mentioned Chad Mendes, and he was someone that was retired for a while, and then he went and did a couple of those, if I'm not mistaken. He looked pretty good. So I guess we can't ever put anything past you guys. You guys all seem to train even when you're done, and you put in so much time in building your names. It's fun to always throw it out there. Another guy you mixed it up with, I think, Jason Knight, he also did it. So this isn't a foreign thing for fighters that are no longer in MMA to go to another sport. So that's good to hear. Is it an astronomical number or is it a reasonable number that you would tell David Feldman from BKFC?
I wouldn't say it's astronomical, but it just has to be worth the time and it'd have to be an amount of money that I could take care of my family with for a long while. So, and you know, like the bare knuckle thing, I think any MMA fighter, it's kind of on their, I'd say maybe it might be on their bucket list because that's how MMA started, was the bare knuckle. That was like the brutal days back then. That's what made me a fan of the sport. That's what made me want to do it. So I'd never say never to anything. It's just, you know, it's got to be worth my time to put in the training and to put my business on hold and everything and go back and do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Diego's another one. So that's what 3 guys have named off that have mixed it up, you know, and then if you throw in Jose Aldo, he boxed.
Yep.
So a lot of people are doing things outside. It looks like the UFC's allowing them to do this, so it's feasible. And it sounds like you're down, and hopefully if promoters listen to it and they want to do something like that, then maybe you guys can make it happen, and hopefully your family would support it and not get pissed at the junkie guys for lighting the fire, right?
Right. We'll see. Yeah, man, we'll see what happens. But, you know, I'm retired right now, but never say never.
As always, it's great to catch up with you. Good luck with everything, your business, everything going forward. And hopefully this thing with Rogan can pick up some steam. And we'd love to see your dad chopping it up with him. And we can all learn a little bit more about, you know, the history of Cuba from somebody that was right there in the trenches for real, you know?
Yeah.
So, Rick, take care, brother.
Always great catching up. Thank you, guys. I appreciate it.
All right, you too, man. See ya. Man, I thought that little incident in the elevator was going to lead to some sort of a fight.
Yeah, you would think so, right? Close quarters like that. Maybe what did save him was the fact that he didn't see him. Because had they locked eyes, I think something's got to be said, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, one thing we failed to ask him was how much is your lady showing? Because if it's a big old belly, then I would think gentlemen would be gentlemen and go, that's not the time. But yeah. Baboon's crazy. That's good backup to have for starters.
And that sounds exactly like what he would say too.
And I don't know what McGregor's backup situation was like. You know, they can be goons too. You saw when they all hopped in that private plane just to make a run at that bus that Habib was on. So there's some G's on both sides there. But yeah, I thought that story was going to take off a little bit more. But the tension and then the Irish accent that Llamas gave us was worth it.
Dude, one of the funniest things, and there have been a bunch, but on our military trips, one of the funniest things I ever saw was the first night, the first meal on the way from the airport. So Baboon had a BKFC fight like that weekend, right? Like the next week or something like that.
Yeah.
So he was cutting weight. And Ricardo Llamas says that when he was cutting weight, that Baboon would eat whatever, like, and he would eat it in front of him. So he was trying to get payback. So he was just ordering, like, he'd ask him, like, hey, what looks good? And he goes, man, pizza looks good. He'd give me one of those. And he would eat it right in front of him. But then he would start arguing with Palomino, doing Palomino impression. So it was like Palomino arguing with himself. It was such a good impression. And they were just arguing with each other. It was so funny, dude. And I tried to get him to do it again. And he says, it just has to come out. But when he impersonates Luis Palomino, oh my God, dude, it's like spot on.
He does a good Robert De Niro too.
Does he? Oh, yeah.
He does a good Robert De Niro.
Does the face and everything.
If you guys want to look up that spoof or whatever it was, I mean, this was 10 years ago, but he was trying to get on McGregor's radar a little bit and make fun of him. But I remember when McGregor, I think he was saucing or something, and he was like, he was really pissed at it, and he had to go at Llamas. You know, he didn't appreciate it or whatever. But anyway, check it out, folks. So all those things can be found online. I guess Llamas goofs on McGregor. You know, it was about 10 years ago. Chael Sonnen says Alex Fajeda can become the MMA GOAT if he wins the UFC heavyweight title. I think so too. No one's won three UFC titles in three different weight classes. So I would have a hard time arguing with Chael Sonnen on that one.
I would argue a little bit, because I think what I would say is what you did was pretty incredible, but the true measurement is just title defenses, in my opinion. You know, Conor McGregor has been in situations where he could possibly win three belts, but we wouldn't call him the MMA GOAT, right?
No.
What it is for me is something really special that a lot of people have not been able to do. But MMA GOAT means at any time we're having trouble coming up with guys who could have beat you in their prime. And right away, I think if we think, all right, what would a prime John Jones versus a prime Alex Bahia look like? I think we'd all side with John Jones on that one, right?
Yeah, we would. But more than anything, I guess he'd only have one more than Jones, because Jones won two, GSP won two. But Jones and GSP have, I think it's 11 and 9 title defenses. Alex Fajeda's only got one. So if he has one more title and he has three titles versus the other guys is two titles, that is a nice flex. But he only has one title defense versus what the other guys have. So I might concede that, yeah, Jones and GSP are still ahead. But it was an interesting take from Sonnen.
Mm-hmm.
Your thoughts on this whole Diaz-Masvidal tour? I you know, it's pretty cool that they're hitting pretty major cities. They've hit Vegas, New York, Miami, and the last one's LA. I'm digging it. People are showing up. The only thing I don't like goes is I don't want chaos. I don't want, you know, assault and battery and cops getting involved, but come on, get a little closer, right? Like,
yeah,
don't need to headbutt each other, but kind of create a little bit of tension. Make me believe that you really don't like each other. So I can choose one or the other, you know, and hope someone gets their ass kicked. And right now I'm just, I don't know, that they're just not selling it. They're There's too much distance in between them, so it's not giving me that moment of like, oh shit, something's about to break out. I can't miss this one. You know, I don't feel like I want to run to my calendar to say we ain't doing this. We ain't doing nothing on this night because I'm watching this fight, baby. All my friends are coming over. Like, I haven't reached that. They're not doing that.
Right. And to me, you know, it's always up to both fighters to promote a fight. But it's a little bit more on Nate Diaz's side, in my opinion, because he lost the first one. He's the one that has to try and convince us that this fight's going to be different. So I feel like he needs to push a little bit more on his end.
Exactly. We are tuning in to a fight, and it's not a, I mean, it's, it could be, right? But it's not like when the NBA playoffs are over and the teams line up and they all shake hands. No, man, this is a fight. You're trying to hurt someone. So that's why it's a pretty incredible feeling when you win a prize fight. And on the other side, it's kind of a low feeling, you know, but that's what the fans are into. We're choosing a side, and then we're hoping my guy kicks your guys' ass, right? You know, and then we're going to have a blast if that happens. And if it doesn't, then guess what? It's kind of like, it's a shitty feeling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We haven't gotten there. They got one more show to do it in LA. And, you know, either way, I think it'll be good, but I just like, you know, when Nate Diaz submitted that Logan Paul lookalike in New Orleans,
mm-hmm.
for some reason, I really was digging it. I saw a lot of different videos. I saw a lot of different angles. And I was like, damn, man, like Nate still got it. You know, you don't want to hit the streets against that dude or whatever, because there's video of him kind of doing that. And then in this other setting, he's too much of a square, I guess.
Maybe, yeah. Or maybe he's a little intimidated, you know? He does have
Miami, but in New York or Las Vegas, I think it would have been fine. You know, they got their security, but just get closer. Like, they're far apart.
I think they're waiting for the last one to do it. I think Jorge Masvidal, for what people say, I think he's very, very smart. And I think he knows that Nate can be a little bit of a loose cannon. So I think he's thinking, like, we'll get that moment, but let's wait till the end because, you know, we don't want to be risking this night after night. This might be a guy that budges on that a few times, you know?
Yeah. That's a big cross-country voyage, isn't it? Las Vegas to New York to Miami and then back to L.A. Vegas and L.A. are so close, you'd think you'd want to go west and then finish up back east or vice versa. But
yeah.
That's a lot of travel in like 1 week. It was just last Friday they were in Vegas, and I guess they're going to be back in LA in a few days. But anyway, come on, guys. Just get a little closer. If you don't want to shove each other, okay. But literally, you could drive a truck in between you two.
Mm-hmm.
It's just part of selling the fight. I don't know. All right, let's get on out of here. Thank you so much, everybody, for tuning in. Don't forget Spinning Backlick every Monday, noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific. Been seeing a lot of new listeners. Numbers are growing. So if you have anything to do with it via a retweet, a share, a DM, you know, any type of share. Well, I think I already said that. Repost. Trying to remember all the different lingos for all the different social medias. We greatly appreciate it. We think it's a quality show. So if you have an MMA fan, friend, or family, send it to them. And that way they can kind of tune in. It's live every Monday. We're reacting to the latest news from the past week. And it's myself, Goes, and the rotation of other junkie personnel, editors or writers. And again, we're discussing the biggest stories in mixed martial arts. So that show, along with the two junkie radios, it's basically three shows, Goes and I do every week. What were you going to say?
I was going to say just that. You know, when we started that show, it was with the intention of it being kind of like a third junkie radio show, just a little different. And that was one of my goals at the beginning of this year. I want this show to be nominated for a World MMA Award. So
Spinning?
Yeah. You know, within the next 2 years, hopefully by the end of this year, I'd love for it to get nominated for something, because I think it's a quality show. And we see fighters in there all the time watching. notables have been in our chat before. So I'm fired up about it, and I'm glad that it's picking up steam.
Me too. All right. And then on social media, I'm at MMA Junkie George, and Goes is at the Goes. If you want to holler us on X, which is formerly Twitter, or Instagram, those seem to be the two common ones to share and post things. Facebook, you know, I post things there as well. But, you know, I post a lot of family stuff, so I don't want to bore anyone with that. But if you're looking for just stuff related to MMA, the other two seem to provide a little bit more of that. So let's get on out of here, though, and we'll see you guys all for Monday's show, the Junkie Radio and Spinning Backlick. And last thing on Spinning Backlick is, if you do watch, that like and subscribe button, you know, I can only say it on the show a few times without turning people off, but if you're tuning into this show, obviously you support us. That like and subscribe button is pretty important, so hopefully you take the time to do that. I even see other YouTubers say, if you didn't like it, hit the dislike. And I don't know if I want to say that, you know, because I don't think we do anything in it that you should dislike. But I guess if that somehow helps the algorithm, go ahead and do that, you know. In fact, I don't even think I've ever looked to see if we got them. And if we do, then I sure would love to know what's your problem, you know. But I get in there in the YouTube comments, and it's not bad. It's not bad. So far, so good. All right. Go out and be a champion. We'll talk to you soon.